Hi, writers. Welcome to a new episode on the craft of writing fiction. This is Jim Thayer. I received a great question from our listener, Daniel, regarding how he should begin writing. Daniel wrote, "What is the best way to get started on a story? Should I invent an interesting character, put him in a scene with someone and see where it goes? Should I think of an interesting setting and think of what kind of people and which problems would be in the setting? I find that often when I want to write, no ideas come to mind and I stare at the screen until I lose all motivation. Any suggestions?" That's from Daniel. Let me offer some thoughts on how to begin our novel or our short story. Sometimes writing that first line is hard, or beginning the second page, or the second chapter. Sometimes we can't start, or sometimes we stop and can't get going again. There are a couple of reasons for this, I think. The first reason is that sometimes putting our idea for a story onto the screen or onto the paper seems to reduce the story. In other words, as long as the novel is in our minds, it seems perfect. In our head, our novel has all the characters and action and dialogue that make up a wonderful story. And maybe we've researched and outlined our novel, but then we try to start writing the actual novel, the writing, and we realize that maybe our sentences aren't perfect. Maybe our story isn't perfect. The words on our screen don't glitter the way the novel does when it's only in our mind. The actual writing of it seems to make the project less attractive. It seems to reduce it. Our project goes from perfect to non-perfect, and we might resist that. I'm not sure why this mental effect exists, but it does. Maybe the way to handle this reluctance to begin is to tell ourselves that creation of the novel starts with the actual writing of it. Before then, we don't really have anything. When we write that first sentence, we go from having zero to having something. Anything is better than nothing, and so we can begin writing. We aren't reducing our project when we begin the writing. We're building it. And this next thought is related to the first. The biographer W. Jackson Bate believes our reluctance to begin our work, to begin the work on our project, stems from the, quote, inner resistance to dragging oneself, hour after hour, to the bar of self-judgment. That's W. Jackson Bate. What is the bar of self-judgment? It's when we writers produce words, then have to wonder whether our writing is any good. We've been able to avoid the bar of self-judgment as long as we haven't written anything. And maybe that's a reason we're having trouble beginning our project. We don't want to learn if we can write by actually writing something. Maybe we are afraid to learn if we can write. Or maybe the reason we haven't started our story or we can't continue writing it is that something is missing from our story, from our planned story. The great science fiction writer Orson Scott Card says, quote, "Often when you find yourself blocked, when you can't bring yourself to start or continue a story, the reason is that you have forgotten or have not yet discovered what is extraordinary about your main character." I mentioned this in an earlier episode, the elements we likely should have figured out in advance of starting our project. Here is a list of 8 elements we likely should have figured out before we start our novel. Just a sentence each. First, what is the novel's pitch? Second, who is the protagonist? And that includes his or her name. What does she look like? What's her personality? Some of her background and her goals. 3, what is the setting? 4, who are the antagonists? 5, what further research is needed before we begin writing? 6, what are the early obstacles to the hero's reaching her goal? 7, what are the early conflicts? And 8, how can I put conflict in place in the first chapter, in the first pages of the novel? If we have solid answers to these 8 questions, we are ready to start the actual writing of the novel. Any more delay and we might just be putting off the writing for no good reason. We might just be stalling. So these might be the reasons we haven't started writing our novel. Are there any tricks to get us going? Well, maybe. Here's a couple I can think of. Yeah, they're tricks, but they might be useful. First, a novel is a big project. It might be hard to begin a project you know will take a year to finish. Consider dividing the chore of writing the project into small pieces, maybe really small pieces. In fact, make our goal writing the first sentence, a perfect sentence for our novel or story. A perfect sentence, what do they usually consist of? A strong subject, a strong verb, few or no adjectives or adverbs, not too long, a big image. A perfect sentence, here are a couple perfect sentences I wish I had written. They threw me off the hay truck about noon. That's from James N. Cain's The Postman Always Rings Twice. "Where's Papa going with that axe?" said Fern to her mother as they were setting the table for breakfast. That's from Charlotte's Web by E.B. White. And here is from Charles Portis's True Grit, one of my favorite novels. "People do not give it credence that a 14-year-old girl could leave home and go off in the wintertime to avenge her father's blood, but it did not seem so strange then, although I will say it did not happen every day." Type those 10 or 12 words and we have it, a perfect sentence, the first of our story. We're underway. And now we can think about the second sentence. We've begun to build our story. We have something, not nothing. Here's another trick. Those 8 elements mentioned a moment ago that we probably should have determined before we begin writing, figure them out. Even if each element, when we summarize it and write it down, is only a sentence or two, that might be enough to indicate our story is strong and we can begin writing. And here's another method that might help us begin writing our project. I don't recommend it, as it might be a big time waster. But this is what has launched me a couple of times to actually writing. We've researched and outlined and researched and outlined and thought about the project until the first sentence, the first chapter, begs to be written. It simply cannot be put off anymore. It's either start the novel or go crazy. So we start the novel. These have been some thoughts on why getting started can sometimes be hard. These ideas about how to get started with our novel aren't a medical prescription from the pharmacist. They might not be surefire, but they're a crack at the problem. But maybe the reluctance to start the project is no more complicated than this. When the dog barks in the hallway, we get up and let him out. Our novel is sitting in our brain and it's barking. We should get up, go to the desk and let the novel out by starting to write. I mentioned first lines of novels a minute ago. I like thinking about them, and I enjoy coming across wonderful first lines to a novel or short story. An article in the Daily Mail discusses a poll which was commissioned by Amazon Books UK, which asked 2,000 Amazon readers to vote for the, quote, most memorable and captivating opening lines from the world of literature. That's what they were looking for, and here's why first lines of our story are so important. That same poll also found that, listen to this, 64% of readers have stopped reading a novel if the opening lines didn't capture their attention, while 43% of respondents believed that the opening lines can make or break a novel. Here's the poll's list of best first lines. Often it's one sentence, sometimes it's a couple of sentences. Here they are. Here's the best first line in fiction, and it's from Charles Dickens's A Tale of Two Cities. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times. Here's number two from George Orwell's 1984. It was a bright, cold day in April, and the clocks were striking 13. Here is number three, and it's from J.M. Barrie's Peter Pan. All children except one grow up. Number four from J.R.R. Tolkien's The Hobbit. In a hole in the ground there lived a hobbit. Number five from J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. Mr. and Mrs. Dursley of number four Privet Drive were proud to say that they were perfectly normal. Thank you very much. Number six from Matilda by Roald Dahl. It's a funny thing about mothers and fathers, even when their own child is the most disgusting little blister you could ever imagine, they still think that he or she is wonderful. Number seven, this is from The Secret Diary of Adrian Mole, age 13 and a half, by Sue Townsend. It's a couple of sentences, and it's one of the funniest novels I've ever read. And these opening lines alerted me to that. It was to the fact it was so funny. Here is Sue Townsend. First lines. Thursday, January 1st, bank holiday in England, Ireland, Scotland, and Wales. These are my New Year's resolutions. I will help the blind cross the road. I will hang my trousers up. I will put the sleeves back on my records. I will not start smoking. I will stop squeezing my spots. I will be kind to the dog. I will help the poor and ignorant. After hearing the disgusting noises from downstairs last night, I have also vowed never to drink alcohol. That's from Sue Townsend. Number eight, from The Martian. A wonderful novel by Andy Weir. The first line, I'm pretty much, and I'll delete the expletive. Number nine, from C.S. Lewis's The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Once there were four children whose names were Peter, Susan, Edmund, and Lucy. Number ten, from Ian Fleming's Goldfinger. James Bond, with two double bourbons inside him, sat in the final departure lounge of Miami Airport and thought about death. Here is Alice Siebold's The Lovely Bones, number 11. My name was Salmon, like the fish. First name, Susie. I was 14 when I was murdered on December 6, 1973. Number 12, from Gone Girl by Gillian Flynn. When I think of my wife, I always think of the back of her head. I picture cracking her lovely skull, unspooling her brain, trying to get answers. Number 11, the famous first lines from Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen. It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife.
Let's take a quick break.
Hey guys, this is your girl Lira, and you're listening to Self-Reflection Podcast. Thank you guys for joining me on another episode of Self-Reflection Podcast. I hope this podcast episode finds you in the best possible state that you can be in for yourself today. And if you're not doing your best, I hope, you know, you find some time to care for your mental health, physical health, emotional health, spiritual health, and your psychological health. You know, I hope you find some time to do some self-reflection. Just gather yourself and, you know, find the best possible way you can deal with what you're dealing with in this moment, right?
Here is J.D. Salinger's first lines of Catcher in the Rye. If you really want to hear about it, the first thing you'll probably want to know is where I was born and what my lousy childhood was like and how my parents were occupied and all before they had me and all that David Copperfield kind of crap, and I don't feel like going into it if you want to know the truth. That was number 14. Here's number 15 from Douglas Adams' The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Far out in the uncharted backwaters of the unfashionable end of the western spiral arm of the galaxy lies a small, unregarded yellow sun. Number 16, from Bridget Jones's Diary by Helen Fielding. January, an exceptionally bad start. Sunday 1, January, 129 pounds, but post-Christmas. Alcohol units 14, but effectively covers 2 days and 4 hours of party on New Year's. Cigarettes 22, calories 5,424. Number 17 from Colleen Hoover, her novel It Ends With Us. As I sit here with 1 foot on either side of the ledge, looking down from 12 stories above the streets of Boston, I can't help but think about suicide. Number 18, maybe the most famous opening lines in literature from Herman Melville's Moby Dick. Call me Ishmael. Number 19 from Truman Capote's Breakfast at Tiffany's. I am always drawn back to places where I have lived, the houses and their neighborhoods. Number 20 from Suzanne Collins's The Hunger Games. When I wake up, the other side of the bed is cold. Number 21 from P.L. Travers's Mary Poppins, the first lines. If you want to find Cherry Tree Lane, all you have to do is ask the policeman at the crossroads. And here's another famous opening lines from Leo Tolstoy's Anna Karenina, number 22. All happy families are alike. Each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. 23 from Alice Walker's The Color Purple. You better not never tell nobody but God. Here's number 24 from Choke by Chuck Palahniuk. If you're going to read this, don't bother. And the last one, number 25, from Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. I am an invisible man. That's the list, and what a great one. We writers might notice that most of these famous first sentences ask a question, and usually the question is, what's going on? The reader has to keep reading to find out. Successful first sentences engage the reader. And maybe you are like 64% of the respondents to this poll. You have put down a novel because the first sentence didn't grab you. I sure have. And speaking of wonderful first sentences, let's talk about wonderfully awful first sentences. Here are several from this year's Bulwer Lytton Awards. This is an annual contest sponsored by the English Department at San Jose State University. People are invited to compose the opening sentence of the worst of all possible novels. That is a sentence that's deliberately bad. It was a dark and stormy night, is the opening sentence of the novel Paul Clifford by Edward Bulwer Lytton, which was the inspiration for the contest. I've not read that novel. I've heard it's pretty good, but it has that first sentence. The grand prize in the year 2023 was by Maya Pasek of New York. Here it is. She was a beautiful woman. More specifically, she was the kind of beautiful woman who had an hour-long skincare routine that made her look either ethereal or like a glazed donut, depending on how attracted to her you were. And here was the Grand Panandrum Special Award given to Daniel Bradford of Lexington, Kentucky. Here's his sentence. It was a sunny day in Los Angeles, hot and bright. And I was in my office playing Mahjong against myself and losing when she walked in, 120 pounds of dynamite, a blonde with legs that began at her ankles and ended in trouble. Here are two more. This is the winner in the Adventure Award, written by Oliver Mauser of Jacksonville, Florida. The man squinted his eyes at the blistering cold winds battering his rugged face. his eyes darting about, desperately hoping, daring to dream that amidst the frozen wasteland, he would find that last Klondike bar that he had hidden in his freezer. That's the last one. I said I had two more. I only had one. How did the novelist John Cheever worked? As you know, I've been reading Mason Curry's book, Daily Rituals, which tells us how creators worked day to day, their daily work lives, including a number of novelists. John Cheever lived from 1912 to 1982, and he was a novelist and short story writer who won the Pulitzer Prize in 1978. Mason Curry quotes Blake Bailey, who is Cheever's biographer. Cheever lived in New York City. He'd put on his only suit and ride the elevator with other men leaving for work. Cheever, however, would proceed all the way down to the storage room in the basement, where he'd doff his suit and write in his boxers until noon, then dress again and ascend for lunch. Mason Curry continues, after that he had the rest of the day free, and he would often take his young daughter on long walks around the city, bringing her along to the Menemsha Bar on 57th Street if he felt like a drink on the way home. Mason Curry continues, Cheever continued to write pretty much every morning for the rest of his life, but as his career progressed, the writing sessions grew shorter and shorter, while cocktail hour began earlier and earlier. By the 1960s, Cheever's working day was usually over by 10:30 in the morning. Afterward, he would lurk about the house, the family had since moved to the suburbs, pretending to read while waiting for an opportunity to slip unnoticed into the pantry and pour himself a few scoops of gin. His journals begun in the late 1940s and continued for the ensuing three decades record his constant struggle with alcoholism and his attempts to, quote, achieve some equilibrium between writing and living. That's John Cheever's phrase. The following entry from 1971 describes a typical day, and here is John Cheever in his diary. The hour between 5 and 6 is my best. It is dark. A few birds sing. I feel contented and loving. My disconnects begin at 7 when light fills the room. I am unready for the day, unready to face it soberly, that is. Some days I would like to streak down to the pantry and pour a drink. The hours between 7 and 10 when I begin to drink are the worst. I am afraid of cars, planes, boats, snakes, stray dogs, falling leaves, extension ladders, and the sound of the wind in the chimney. I sleep off my hooch after lunch, and very often awake feeling content once more, and loving, although I do not work. Swimming is the apex of my day, its heart, and after this, night is falling. I am stoned but serene, so I sleep and dream until 5. John Cheever was a talented writer, but I don't wish his life on anyone. Well, I want to read a couple more of these Bulwer Lytton award winners. This is the winner in the children's and young adult literature category. It's written by David Snook of Berkeley, California. As Snow White met with her cheaper replacement dwarfs for the first time, shaking hands in turn with the likes of Sweaty, Greasy, and Flabby, aptly named identical twins Grabby and Gropey, and proud owner of a joy buzzer Scabby, she found herself wondering if the savings would prove to be worth it, and she was about to learn why the others were so afraid of the seventh new dwarf, the oddly named Oozy. And here is the winner in the fantasy and horror section, written by Drew Herman of Midlothian, Virginia. In obedience to the thousand-year mandate of the Hawk's Realm, following the prophecy of Glenfric, the Moral Sayer, Clagnar and his, thus far, loyal Death Sword warriors journeyed countless sky turns across the burning plains of Hellsplat and the great eastern Doomsea to an immense shining folks hive that more or less resembled Fresno, but with a more genre appropriate name. And the last one, here is the winner of the historical fiction category, written by Brent Guernsey of Springfield, Virginia. None of the soldiers, their reddened faces wet from boutonniere squirts, their bodies covered in feathers hurled from buckets, wanted to admit the 102nd Clown Infantry Division had routed them at the Battle of Little Big Top. Those are the Bulwer Lytton winners this year. They're just wonderful. That's the end of today's episode. I'm glad you are here for it. This is Jim Thayer. Please keep tapping those keys.